Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I'm so happy and interested to interview a Vashon artist I had never heard of, but I think we will all hear about him very soon. Mike Levitt is doing an exhibit at Vashon Center for the Arts starting on November 7th, and you don't want to miss it. It is going to be fascinating. And let me read you before I talk to Mike. And hi, Mike. Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to read straight out of the copy from Vashon Center for the Arts. Seattle-born artist Mike Levitt has built a career out of turning the familiar into the uncanny, using humor, satire, and craftsmanship to challenge how we consume culture, politics, and products. Goodbye, Cruel World, the name of the exhibit, brings together his biting blend of sculpture, installation, and collectible art, all aimed at dissecting the absurdities of modern consumerism. Boy, that is a lead-in. I mean, who wouldn't be interested to see what does that actually look like? So when you're just talking to people, Mike, saying what you do, you know, you meet somebody at a party, they want to know what you do. What's your short line? Because this is so fascinating, but it doesn't fit, you know, any little mental image of, okay, what does an artist do? He doesn't... So how do you do the short form at a party?
Yeah, the elevator pitch has never been easy for me.
Well, let's not do the elevator pitch. No, let's do the friends, trying to figure you out.
Okay, so I mean, the casual, I've always had the opportunity for, it's a casual elevator pitch. I need to get it short because even people who know me and love me have a short attention span, right? So, I mean, it's true. And I'm not out of love. I do sculpture.
Yeah.
Mostly, I would say figurative work.
Yes.
And so what I'm kind of working backwards here, but what that means for me is that I'm good at capturing a likeness with the sculpture, in three dimensions. And then it forces me into making choices about who I'm sculpting. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then I tend to want to sculpt people who are recognizable. I did start, with family and friends. I literally, my first action figures I ever sculpted were like of my dad and my mom and my sisters and her kids and myself and all that. So I would start with that familiarity. And then eventually it was like, I wanted to kind of slowly branch out. And obviously for me growing up in the 80s and, just feeling like I was kind of inundated with faces and celebrities, it was like, well, that's a natural next step. In my world, it's also been a challenge about sculpting the likenesses of visual art celebrities, which to me, that became very interesting because it's like, well, we know Andy Warhol. We might not know his face or the other faces around him.
But
he helped create the career of Lou Reed and Velvet Underground and, things like that. I found that fascinating. The faces behind the scenes that we know well.
Yeah.
That got me into the film directors later on. Like, we all know and love these movies. We might know something about the people behind those movies, but to me, that was I felt like that was when I really got into, I'm obviously beyond my elevator pitch.
Yeah. So let me just back up and say, so people can orient, because you are actually internationally known for your action figures.
Right.
That's the word that people describe, but you pick interesting subjects, many of whom we know, perhaps not all, and you capture them in a way that's not like traditional sculpture. You're not trying to make a visual likeness that everybody can put in a museum and say, "Oh, it's." You're telling us something about their world, and you've got an element of comedy, satire, wit that goes along with it. But there's also something that you're not mocking them. You're bringing something out. So why action figures? And how do you describe an action figure?
Okay, well, the action figure thing, again, back to me growing up in the 80s and Star Wars and G.I. Joe, I was obsessed with those things as a kid, right? Uh-huh. I just completely fixated. I mean, I can still remember, my daughter's at the same age now in first grade where I was just, I couldn't live life without them. Waking up, thinking about them, falling asleep, thinking about them. So there's that. And the more I deconstructed that later on, it became more about, well, actually, there's something very wrong about that. That as a small child, I became fixated on a corporate product. And, you know, that got me into this whole other line of work. I'm like, well, you know, I don't like that. It's still happening now. So let's get into that. That's why I've made other work about it. Criticism, I guess, as a kid, criticism isn't the right word, but there's the action figure and then there's the Barbie doll. And as I guess it was probably a boy girl thing, as I'm sure there's a bit of sexism here, but as a boy or as boys, we would get really offended if our parents or, you know, older siblings would call our action figures dolls. Like, no, they're not dolls. They don't have clothing or cloth. You know, they're meant for action. We can throw these things around. They don't get dirty. I guess that was part of it. Another part of that kind of evil genius about those corporate products designed for kids was that they were small and they were actually, I think, very intentionally thought of to go in a kid's pocket so they could be traveling around. And you got to think back a long time ago. There's a lot of toys like that nowadays, you know, very small fidgety things. They're just everywhere. There's a billion different kinds of them. There wasn't a lot like that. I mean, you have a yo-yo, you know, you've got other things you could kind of fidget with, but not on that scale of production, you know, and variety. Like you get a yo-yo and there's like, is red or blue or green or something, but you know, there's all kinds of characters and worlds. And especially, you know, when Star Wars comes out and, you know, George Lucas was very cognizant of this, merchandising the products, pushing it out in so many different realms. So it would be in all these different stores and, you know, in different packages and varieties, all that. So I guess I'm differentiating between a doll and action figure because there's a subtle difference, but it's kind of important to me personally. And I think it's just interesting because there's a different, you know, I mean, in a loving way, I think a doll comes with a lot more storytelling, and you're imagining scenarios with the dolls, and, you know, you're kind of living with them and they become part of your life or fantasy. Our action figures, we would do some of that for sure, but it was also about just trashing the things, and we'd strap firecrackers to them and see if they would survive. No. You know, and then the collecting was another big part of it. Like, well, you have that one, I have this one. I mean, there's some of that with the Barbie doll, but I don't know. There's subtle differences that I find them personally fascinating, and I think they're indicative of other larger things.
Right. So you got part of your art education by going to Pratt, renowned art school, but you didn't stay there. What was it like to be, you know, somebody who had this penchant for action figures at a traditional art school?
It's right. So I didn't really want to stay there. It was very much of a art, how do you describe it? You know, just art school. The kind of institution you would imagine a very traditional art school to be. And this would have been in 1996, late 90s, I felt like the place should have evolved by at that point. You know, like I was interested in performance art and video art and, you know, all kinds of other realms. The action figure thing, I wasn't totally into at the time. It came kind of at the very end, tail end of college. I didn't think of those as a line of work for me at the time. I mean, I may have had like a distant aspiration, but it wasn't the thing. I was just open to those. I was open to making products as a form of art and that kind of thing. And at Pratt, you could go into those things. There was definitely like product design, but you had to pick a lane very quick. And that's what really turned me off was the end of my freshman year. I remember, you know, school counselor, somebody coming in, handing us all a form and is like, here is your choice of classes for the next 3 years. And first of all, you got to pick a major and then your class set will be assigned for you for the next 3 years. Maybe some electives, but not really, you know. And I was right there. I was like, wait a second. First of all, I don't know what I want to focus on. I was a good painter, I was a good drawer, but I was in a sculpture. And right there, you had to like decide. And you could still kind of dabble, but I just, it was kind of like that in other ways.
Yeah, I can imagine how constraining that would have been, because part of art is opening your eyes and considering possibilities and exercising your creativity and making combinations of things that nobody has ever done before. So when you say, no, painting or drawing or sculpture or product design or design work, you know, you go, but where's the new life going to come from?
It was very weirdly just contradictory. You know, that was a long time ago. Maybe they've changed. I don't know, but I don't know. To give them credit, it's like it's school. It's foundational. You know, they're kind of, I think, just to defend them, which they don't need it, my work doing that, but it would be them saying like, look, you can do whatever you want. We're just going to provide you this set of skills.
Right.
And that's, you know, and I was like, well, I already kind of have some of that, you know, in this department, and I want to study like 8 other things at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's where I ended up at Evergreen.
Yeah, much better for that sort of creative mix, kind of blend your own combination of all sorts of things. How great, right. Did you know at that point you wanted to be a professional artist? You wanted to make your living?
That's another interesting point. No, I didn't. You got to put yourself in a 19-year-old brain, you know, like you really don't know. You think, you know, your ego is sky high, right? And your confidence is sky high. I'm going to survive forever. I'm never going to get sick. I'm, you know, like I have plenty of time. And at the same time, I don't know anything and I'm terrified and the world is completely uncertain. I have no idea how I'm going to make it, you know, through this life. You have those two different things going on. I took a year off after Pratt and I didn't know if I wanted to finish college. I didn't know what I was doing it for. I didn't see myself as a professional artist. I was really into art education at the time. I actually, at that point, at that very point, I was kind of decided that I wanted to start my own art school, right? So I was just like, well, I'm going to fix this. You know, I'm going to start from scratch and make it good. My parents had both, they had actually met while starting a school within a school on Mercer Island. And so this is back in the 70s. So I have that very deep background. And, you know, I spent a year off. I did a lot of different projects. I did a year at the UW taking different classes, kind of sampling. And it wasn't until I finally did enroll at Evergreen, my third school in 4 years, that I was like, okay, I'm going to try to do this. I have no idea how, but I think I'm going to commit and try to become a professional at it. I still didn't know how to make money at it. That was a gigantic mystery to me. And it wasn't until the very, very tail end, my like last quarter at Evergreen, right before I was graduating with my 180 credits, when I had a really good professor, Paul Sparks, he kind of pressed me on this. He's like, well, you know, if you're going to try to do this, you need a logo, you need a letterhead, you need to brand yourself, you know, and you need to break even. So just find a way to make enough where you're not losing money. And that alone is a really nice framework and a really nice, it's like, okay. At the time, one of my senior projects there, which was all by choice, didn't have to do one. I was having the opposite of writer's block. I was having too many ideas and not making anything about it.
Yeah.
So I was kind of stuck not making, but a ton of ideas. So I was filling sketchbooks with drawings for sculptures and performances and installations. And the professor, Paul, was like, you know, I'm going to fail you if you don't actually make something. Like, this is all great. It's like, cool. You have, these are great ideas, but you got to start putting your hands on a material. And good challenge, really good challenge. And so I was still like, oh, but which one, you know? And so what I decided, I was sitting in a McDonald's. there's been a few moments like this in my life where I'm right in the middle of corporate America and it's swimming around me, but I'm having a creative moment and a free moment. Like, I don't know what it is. It's like when I'm consuming the worst of it somehow. It's kind of like, okay, all right, all right. And so I'm sitting there in the McDonald's, I was thinking about all these ideas, I'm eating terrible food, and how am I gonna make something out of all these sketches? But somehow it came up for me, again, growing up in the 80s, the baseball cards. And what it was, I think I had the sketchbook out in front of me and I started kind of like thumbnailing them with a frame and maybe even some titles. And I'm looking at them like, huh. And then I was thinking playing cards, I was about to do this one. I could make each sketch, each drawing a playing card so it would actually play with my options. I was going to like turn that into a performance. And I really liked that idea. So kind of running with that. But the baseball card thing was really sticking too. And I had to work fast. I had to decide because I was running out of time. I had to make something. And so I started sketching out the cards. I figured, well, whether they're playing cards or baseball cards, it's going to be a matter of framing and titling. I'm going to start making drawings at that size, at this exact size. They're all the same size. Figured I could make prints and cut them out. And I started drawing. And as I did, I realized the baseball cards could become this almost endless iterations. So it's getting back to the stuff I grew up with, right? And then I was starting to sense like, well, that might make some kind of money. I don't know how. Again, I'm just trying to think break even, right? I'm not trying to become a millionaire, just how to make any money at this. And it happened pretty quickly. I was living in a house in Olympia, off campus with friends. We had a lot of parties on weeknights and people would be over and I'd be drawing. I'd be busy. And they would come up like, what are you doing? Well, I'm making baseball cards. Really? You know, can we buy them? And I was just barely done drawing any and was already kind of getting offers.
And what were you drawing anything with relation to baseball or just...
No.
Just sketches? Or?
Okay, basically not. It was half of them were the sketches from my sketchbook, so from my ideas, bringing them into fruition, some sort of visual reality, and then the other half were famous art. It was my ideas and my influences.
Okay.
So all the other artists that inspired me. So I'm just trying to lay it all out in front of me. I want to see it all. That was just the first step. But then, like I said, as I'm kind of slowly, casually showing them, people are like, huh, can I have that? And you know, and so before, like, I just started printing them really quickly, and I started wrapping them in packs of bubble gum, and then, you know, the parties would go on. I still hadn't even had my show yet, and people were
had
like,
had you passed your course yet?
No, we hadn't finished. I hadn't finished the class. My thesis show and the class were all kind of ending in May or June or whatever. And
you're already selling these things.
Yeah, I was already selling. There was a street festival in Olympia. I took them out for that. They went well. I'm not making a lot of money, but some. Like, it was starting to trickle in. It was validation, right?
Yeah,
it was like,
breaking even.
Yeah, and it was just a few bucks at a time. Like, and that alone was like, okay, this is significant because I can build on that. If I make $5 of this, well, maybe I can make 10 and maybe I can make 25. And then I'm selling eventually. So right after school, I think I've lined up shows at cafes and bars in Seattle. And then I'm making full sets and they're $50 at a time. And then I'm selling larger prints of the drawings and those are $100. And, you know, I'm just very slowly, step by step building.
Interesting. I'm talking today with Mike Levitt, who is doing a fabulous new show at VCA starting November 7th. We're talking about his start as an artist and some of the amazing projects he's done. Mike, when you're talking about this theme of, it sounds, and tell me if this is true, that you have a bundle of ideas and you also have a lot of craft. Is that still true? Are you over full of what you could create and your ideas as you go, you know, think of what you want to do?
Yes. Yeah. It's those two things go hand in hand and they battle each other because like for me, my craft is very detail oriented. It requires a lot of time and a lot of finish work.
There was some stat I saw about how long it takes to do an action figure.
What did you find out?
Well, it sounded like it was hours and hours or weeks create one.
Yeah, the actual sculpting for me, to make a 6-inch tall figure out of polymer clay, it's Fimo and Sculpey, it's kids clay, cooks in a regular oven. You can buy it at a, well, when there was an art supply store. anyways, readily available material. It takes me about 2 weeks to sculpt a figure. That's just the sculpting time alone. Now, when we're talking about taking a product or a figure into production with a company, there's a lot of back and forth.
Are they mass produced?
So, okay, right. So now, yeah, to back up on my story from the trading cards, but there's a, it's not a big step, but there's an important step there, because the next logical step from the trading card, from the two-dimensional portrait, was to the three-dimensional portrait, and which the commodifiable three-dimensional portrait, which to me was the action figure. It was like very, I collected both as a kid. It was like, obviously. So when I was making these trading cards, and the ones that were selling well were Frida Kahlo, Jackson Pollock, Vincent Van Gogh, you know, famous artists. And so I made a figure of myself. I was making them as gifts for my family, of my family members. And then it was when I made an action figure of Jackson Pollock, and the first person that saw it was like, make another one. Just right now. Like, you know, it's just an immediate, do that again. So I was, all right, I'll do that again. And then it just, that snowballed quickly into, you know, more shows. And again, step by step, it took years, but eventually it went from me making one at a time in my house, trying to sell them for $100 a piece or $200 a piece, to showing in New York City, sculpting out of wood, 3 feet tall, in a fancy Chelsea art gallery for $10,000 a piece.
Yeah. Did you mass produce at all?
Right. And so, yes, thank you. Back to that. So somewhere in the middle there of that progression, I was approached, and I was approached about going into production a lot, not by Mattel or Hasbro, like, hey, you want to, you know, do 1,000 of these. It was more people who are kind of on the periphery of the scene. Like, have you ever thought about it? I think you should, you know, go into production. I think blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, my line was always like, that sounds great. Do you know anybody? And how much is it going to pay? And how hard is it? And the answer was always complicated. A lot of smaller companies and even bigger ones, I mean, not to get too nuts and bolts about it, but this is about how artists are not really compensated well for their work. Because as a kid, I was always wondering, I'd be holding this little figure that was really well made, and I'd be fascinated, like, who made this? Like, this is cool. Look at this tiny little face and this little hand. Who did that? Was this a human? And it was human. There was no machines involved at the time. You know, like, this is fascinating to me. And I was always interested in the people behind it. And that was always just a gigantic mystery. Now, years later, we kind of know some of those people. So with the toy companies, you know, the idea for compensating artists was, it never sounded that great. A lot of those companies would be paying in product, where you would actually just get a box of 1,000 of your own toys that you would, if you want to make any money, you have to sell them yourself. Which to me was like, I mean, what? I mean, okay, great, but that sounds like a lot more work. I want to sculpt the thing and then be done. Not have to like market and brand and create a company.
Yeah, you know? Which you're doing, and then you're making a lot of money on me, but you give me more work.
Yeah, it's like working backwards. It's double the work. Yeah. So yeah. So it took a long time for me to find the right toy company. It was a small one in New York, in Brooklyn, that basically a mom and pop, technically, is a man and his wife. He had made an Obama action figure in 2008 for that election, and it sold really well. Made enough money where he's like, I need to start a business out of this now. And very slowly, I had already kind of been in touch with the guy loosely, just because of social networking or whatever. And he kind of knew about me, and I kind of knew about him. And then he approached me. I think it was, he wanted me to re-sculpt his Hillary prototype. I did that. That went okay. And I think the very next one after that was Bernie Sanders, came up real quick. So this is now all the way up to 2016. We had done actually a couple other prototypes. I did a Banksy figure with him that was very complicated, kind of sold well. But it was that Bernie Sanders figure in 2016, right in the heat of that primary, the Bernie Hillary thing. And, you know, I get Jason is his name, Jason Feinberg, who owns the company Factory, it's without the vowels, FCTRY. He calls me up or texts me and Mike, can you sculpt a Bernie figure? And I could sense it. I mean, it was so topical and so hot. And I was like, yeah, but I would have needed to have it done yesterday, you know? And I was right in the middle of working on my last New York show at the time. Just terrible timing also. I just didn't have the time, but I said, okay, great. I'm gonna drop it, everything I'm doing, and just, yeah, for I think it was 9-10 days solid. This is kind of like before kids, not sleeping at night, working late, you know, waking up early and sending pictures before it's done so that we're already going through that review and design process. And he had a Kickstarter campaign built for that before I even shipped out the figure. I mean, it went great. We sold a bunch of them already before they were even manufactured.
And so it sounds like it was more of a collaborative partnership rather than the way you would work with a normal toy company where you're one of many and you're selling.
Well, I get paid a royalty, a small one. And that was part of that negotiation. It took a while. We also didn't agree on that by the time I had finished or when the Kickstarter went up and the money was coming in. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, you're going to find me retelling the same stories over and over again, but it's really an artist having to advocate for themselves very strongly. And you have to be so forthright because there's no backing and there's no infrastructure and there's nobody behind you. There's nobody to the side of you to like reach out for. There's no safety net. You're just one in a sea and you have to just go because that's it. If you don't do it, you're done.
So if you're not, if you don't have your own back, nobody else is going to have it. And you're often negotiating with folks who've been doing it for a while, who've got their lawyer team and all of the marketing people and everybody else. There's a little army there and you've got to hold your own.
Yeah. And I think it's an important lesson for artists who are well established or mid-career or further along, who are facing these tough choices and establishing artists too, and younger artists like you. I mean, I was told this. And it was very valuable advice from a couple different artists that were older than me when I was young. And it's really stuck with me that you just have to watch your back because you will get screwed no matter what. Because that's just the way the world works. And it's not an American story necessarily. I mean, this is kind of around the world. You know, you're just like, if you don't advocate for yourself, and it's hard when it's your personal message and it's emotional. And, you know, my work is a little different, but if you're making paintings that have this very emotional tie, you know, and tenderness to it, vulnerability, it's that much harder.
Totally hard. Yeah, because part of what I think about is that sensitivity and a little bit of vulnerability and ability to take in the world is what makes us artists. And yet at the same time, it also makes us sensitive and vulnerable. And we're likely to feel the reactions and judgments and harshness of the world. And so that's a real hard line to walk. And what I hate is when you hear about somebody who gave their life to their art, even Jackson Pollock, who lived on food stamps or the equivalent, and the moment he dies, he becomes valuable. Now that is
tragic.
That really gets my goat. I don't know how to describe it. It's like, can't you guys shovel some of that money down to younger artists while they're going rather than wait for somebody like vultures to die? Because the moment they die, like Basquiat, boom, super valuable. And you go, and you killed him. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's true. No, it's absolutely true. I think it's a trigger for me too. It's about that, I think, is about lost potential. Really. I mean, when it comes down to it, it really gets me. Like I think for me, what I see is a lot of people who could be successful artists, maybe not even money wise, you know, financially, but could do great work, who get stuck at the very first step because they just don't have the, I guess it's the courage or whatever it is, but just to like try to see some of their potential and try to see it through, you know, like.
Yeah, well, it's hard. And I think it's also, I mean, it sounds like your parents were supportive and you had friends and things like that. I mean, that helps a lot. You had a certain mental stability, I'm assuming.
Yes.
So you
those
can,
are big. All that stuff.
Yeah, you can stand tall. So if you have that kind of connection, yes. But if you're fragile and you're coming from a background that hasn't allowed you the basics.
Yeah.
It's a whole different story. So it's interesting because you You both have to commercialize your art in order to live on a certain level, and yet I sense a certain anti-commercialism in your storyline too. Is that a tension that you hold?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that really hinges on a big choice that I've made, and that's to commit to trying to make a career out of it, to be a professional, to get paid for it. I know a fair amount of artists, I would say most of them, let's say three quarters that aren't committed to it in that way. I don't want to say not committed because they're not serious about it. It's that they've got a day job or they got a side work or whatever it is, or a spouse or an endowment or, you know, whatever it is. They've got something else that keeps them going financially. So they don't have to necessarily make money at it. I've committed to that path and it does trap me exactly into that hole where I'm trying to make money at something that, I mean, in essence, probably shouldn't be commercialized at all in a way. I mean, sad, but true. I mean, I think in order to be fully free for art to, you know, like we're talking about, for people who are very vulnerable and sensitive to take in the world and to ingest it and then get inspired by it and re-express it, that should be unencumbered by anything, including money and sales and marketing and branding and advertising, all, you know, all that should just be out the window.
So before I ask you about, I want to ask more about your show, because I'm talking today with Mike Levitt, who's doing a show opening on November 7th at VCA. Just going back to that early thought you had about being a teacher, because it sounds like you actually have some really important messages for young artists. Have you thought more about that, or do you do anything with young artists?
I definitely think about it a lot. I would love to. I think it's probably in the next phase of my life at some point. And to be totally honest with you, Sally, right now, it's what I wrestle with is, you know, those who can't do teach and blah, blah, blah. Like that whole thing, like, is it giving up? Is it me, you know, throwing in the towel?
I could get that.
Right.
And I could get that. And it's so tricky because I'm a former educator, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and I taught in university, and people would say to me things like, well, how much are you making? Mm-hmm. Well, you're not valuable then. You must be teaching because you're not valuable. And I would want to slap them. I'd say, you know, I'm not making a lot of money because we're keeping your tuition level down. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I should be making more than some of the high-tech people in across the lake because we're doing something that's super valuable. But
absolutely.
Again, it's the culture and all. But you've already proven you can do. So now, teach, it'll be from a whole different place.
I appreciate that. And I believe that. And I do appreciate that. I know that part. I am a capitalist at heart to a certain degree. Right. Yeah. And I fight against it. I don't like living with it. I hate that part.
And yet you live on Vashon and you pay King County taxes.
So yes, we're all, and it's been, the more I, you know, I'm working on a talk for the show also. And the more I work on the speech for that talk, it's definitely around this idea that, we're fighting capitalism. I think we're at a peak moment of capitalism right now in this world. And at the same time, we have to live with it and we have to survive. So I think this is well beyond art. I think a lot of us wrestle with this, that we don't like it. We hate every part about it. And yet every day we go out and we have to deal. We can't just barter our way through this world, unfortunately, sadly enough, but maybe you can in certain ways in some parts of the world.
No, but I think one of the big skills that I think we all need is the ability to live with paradox or polarity or two things at the same time. And somewhere, I think art can help us do that. I don't know, I don't have words for that, mm-hmm. but somehow art isn't a this or that kind of thing.
Absolutely. No, that's a good point. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So what is your message and what's behind your show at VCA? How long has this been in the offing? And I know I did read what they said about your show, but in your own words, what's it about?
It's about everything we've just been talking about. I mean, I think... I started a lot of this work last year for another show in Seattle with waste product. And so there's a whole body of quote trash talking work in the show that is all made out of recycled material. very intentionally chosen. There's a lot of shoes, Air Jordans, where I'm making, as one example, where I'm taking cigarette cartons from cigarette companies in North Carolina, where Michael Jordan is from, to make the Air Jordan shoe.
Ah.
And so it's just one example where I'm picking on companies by picking up their waste products and making another product out of it. So I guess I'm trying to make fun of capitalism as a way of living with it too, as a way of just turning it inside out, looking at it from a different perspective. That, you know, yes, just like we've been saying, that we have to live with it, but we can kind of hate on it at the same time. Why not?
Yeah.
And especially right now, I feel like, you know, it's so weird that there's a lot of other work in this particular show, the VCA, coming up. I have other figurative work that was all inspired again by product satire. So again, I'm making fun of commercialism. So there's that work. This other body of work that I did for Seattle last year, it debuted in Georgetown on the day of Trump's first assassination attempt last summer. And it was such a weird moment because I had built up a lot to that, to promote that show, to bring everybody there, get everybody out, yada, yada. I remember somebody, a good old friend of mine, had walked up to me in the middle of that opening, and it's just a swirl. I'm trying to, like, you know, this is one of these moments where I have to make the most of it. And, you know, I've done everything, and Brian Quist comes up, I mean, an old friend from elementary school comes up, and he's like, you know what happened right now, right? And I'm like, no. He's like, wow, I can't believe I get to tell you this. Because to me, as soon as he told me, I'm like, oh, well, there goes the election. And I was already very invested. I still did activism. I still volunteered for Kamala. I was still calling in swing states and still fundraising. I was auctioning off Kamala action figures that I was hands customizing to fundraise for her campaign. I mean, I still did it afterwards, but I could just sense like that was a very pivotal moment. And for me, that election, and I still had some sense of optimism, even leading up to election day as well. It's close. Maybe she can get it. But it was for a lot of us, I think, a very big turning point.
Didn't I see, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but that you have a sculpture that is a gun made from marble?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Okay, so I have about 6 or 8 different handmade gun sculptures that mm-hmm. I've done in the show. They are not actual guns, although some of them look a lot like it.
Yeah.
Inspired by the same idea that there is consumerism going on around the gun thing, which is terrible, absolutely terrible. I mean, you know, you hear these statistics about the gun owners. There's very few of them, but they own more guns than there are people in America, something like that. You know, it's just basically what it comes down to is a smaller handful of collectors. Is what it comes down to. Yes, they feel endangered and they feel threatened. But what really gets my goat is that they're buying 10, 20, 100 at a time and stashing away. They don't have any intention of using these things. They just like how they look. They're pretty. They have a little iteration. Oh, it's a collector's item. Oh, nobody has that. Oh, I put that thing on there because it becomes a fetish about materialism. Absolutely. And I'll talk to any of them about that, and I'll bet you a lot of them won't admit it. They love how they look, you know, and they're proudly displayed on the wall. It's never going to get used for anything. So I don't really have an intention to go after gun owners or collectors. It's more about the company is responsible for making those things. So like the Marlboro Glock. Let's see, what was that connection? The Glock, I think, is manufactured in Ohio. Ah, I think it was Virginia. It was the shooting of Virginia Tech. If I remember correctly, it was either where the Glock was manufactured or used. I have all this emblazoned in metal plaques on the wall for the show. This is the reason people come. Because yeah. I've told these stories and I put them down, engraved them in metal so I didn't have to remember them all.
But, really
but
good.
Those connections I was making about you know, where the guns are made, where they've been used for tragedy. and trying to draw a direct line between the two.
So how does it come to you? Do you ever have to search for an idea of what to do next, or do you have something that where the synapses boom, 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 come together and you say, Virginia, gun, Marlboro, boom?
That body of work, I would say, was a lot more researched. But there was an aha moment for the first gun that I chose to make for that body. And it, again, happened to be in the middle of a corporate chain in America. It was in the middle of a Costco, and I had a very similar moment. This is now 24 years later. I'm in a Costco downtown, and the corporate world is swimming around me. It's weird what happens when you're in a place like that and you stop and pause. You just stop shopping for a second. And you don't have an intention behind you about what to get and what to buy. And you just suddenly like hold off and just kind of back up. Because you suddenly start, it doesn't take much. And suddenly it's just like, whoa. It's just, everyone's like, I was holding a bag or in front of the bags of Disney, organic Disney apples. At the time, it was Ron DeSantis in Florida fighting Disney, also fighting gun control. There had been mass shootings in Florida. And it was those dots that were kind of swimming in my head at the time. And looking at these Disney apples, I'm thinking about Florida, and I was thinking, well, what if I made a... And then it was, there's the bags, and there's actual cardboard box. And it was the cardboard box with the Mickey Mouse face on it. I mean, the apples and the organic part was also a big, like, it was a big, like, what is going on here? My brain was kind of like off and like, how? No. That's just whatever. Like, it's just very distracting and weird. And how do these things go together? And I think it, just kind of rattled me. But then I'm thinking, what if I made an AR-15 out of that box with a big Mickey Mouse face on it? Because it would get to the Disney and the DeSantis thing. And as soon as I had that idea, I was like, I better make that. I better make that. And that's usually what it comes down to for me, is if I have an inspiration and then the thought comes, like, I need to make that. And then if it doesn't go away, mm-hmm. if I sleep on it, if it keeps coming back to me a couple days later, that's kind of getting to my decision-making process. If I'm never wanting for ideas, but if I'm not even thinking about it or not looking at them, they keep recurring in my brain, like, okay.
That's something. The one. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I don't really know.
It's talking. It's saying, come on. I'm ready.
And yeah. It's the intuition. You have to kind of trust that. I don't, again, I'm still very uncertain. I'm still, I don't have a lot of confidence, honestly. I mean, about a lot of these things, I don't really know. No one really knows. I don't know what's going to be successful. I don't know what's going to be offensive. I don't know what could ruin my career. I mean, honestly, there's all these things when I'm choosing to make something, especially to go public with it. There's real danger involved. There's real risk involved.
And now more than ever.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking, this is a side note, but in that stage of life when you finally decide to teach, I can imagine you leading a group of high schoolers into a Costco, and just saying, it's here, folks. Go and shift your reality so you can see where you are with different eyes, because there's a whole world and you never know what you might find, because you found truth in a McDonald's and product ideas in Costco. And I don't think a lot of people walk with those kinds of eyes. I think you have a gift, but it's something that would be hugely cool for you to be able to share, and teach people how to notice.
Thank you for bringing back to that, because I I'm glad you did, because I was thinking my thought on that, which I had left pinned to my brain, was I'd like to think, being a capitalist at heart, mm-hmm. I like to think, as a teacher, I like to think about the consumer of that product, which is the student, and from their perspective. And I know as a kid, I loved it when any professional came into the room. It's like, oh, well, you know how to do this. You're actually doing this out there in the real world. So tell me, what? Because I was tired of losing my teacher, because I thought they were the ones that, may have known, but now they can't hack it. So then they're here teaching.
Oh, no.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly.
It's true. It's right? The meme that's there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a big truth to it, but I'm just trying to be honest. Like,
no.
There's an instinctual thing about it, right?
Yeah.
So I guess at the same time, I remember a great teacher. I have done a fair amount of teaching over the years also. That was kind of like one of my last side jobs before quitting side work and going into art full time. But I remember a really good teacher who I was going into elementary school. My last side job, I was going to elementary schools in Seattle where the PTA would fundraise for me to just totally on the side because they were already losing their art department or art teacher back then. And I remember going to a fifth grade class. His name was Carl Chu. And he had been established artist in Seattle. And you know, then he was there teaching full time at the public elementary school. And I remember feeling myself looking at him with a judgmental eye, but then very respectfully asking him, like, what happened? You know, what was it? And him saying to me, you know, like, Mike, it was a choice. Like, I want to do this. I want to be here. And I could, and then, you know, I was kind of in and out of his classroom for a few months, and every day that passed, I was like, oh yeah, this guy's having fun. He's having a lot of fun. He's getting inspired. You know, it was really, I see what it was giving back. And I, you know, I definitely look forward to it. I'm not opposed to it. I'm not as wary as I sound right now about it.
Well, it's another stage, and you don't need to predict what that's going to be, but at least the door can be cracked open, because I imagine that you would be really good, you know? I saw a picture of I think it's an action figure you did with Andy Warhol that had a tomato can base to it. Who are your art action heroes?
Oh, man. Yeah, I always struggle to name people. Banksy is a big one, I guess, for the last, you know, in the last couple of decades. I think he's been inspiring in a way. His ambition, the kind of scale he can execute, even to just say, for example, put up a mural on the wall in Gaza, you know, like little things like that.
Say Banksy? I didn't catch
it. You know, where he'll even a smaller project, he does a lot of bigger things now, but even just getting up one little piece will involve a league of people, a legion, I should say, of people signing non-disclosure agreements, of people that are paid, volunteers. That to me is fascinating and very inspiring, that it's not about the art necessarily. It is great work, but also about teamwork and, you know, collaborating, and he's got to get a lot of people on the same page. Nobody, you know, really is divulging his identity and things like that. He's one of them. Who else is it? Warhol is definitely, I mean, from the past, but he is still for me a big one. I think he had his own kind of legion of collaborators that was innovative and interesting. I think about Christo also in that way. There was a great documentary on Christo kind of made during his heyday about, he was sitting in the middle of it was the running fence, that like 20 something mile long fabric fence that ran through some of the hillsides of California. And he was, in the middle of like some sort of, community meeting, I think, where he had to kind of like, you know, run a key PR campaign and convince a bunch of community members, probably in a small town not too dissimilar from Vashon. They were all angry about it. Like, what is it? You know, you're ruining our farmland and you want to do what? You know, and just, this is for art. And I mean, the moment, and I know it was very well edited for a documentary, but the moment which really got me, he's up there kind of testifying, he has a microphone, he's got a kind of an angry mob in front of him. He gets up on the mic. He's like, you know, it's not about the fabric and the color and the fence and the poles. And he's like, he turns to them. He's like, this is the art. You are part of the art right now. You know, this is the performance and me talking to you and you being here. And he's getting emotional. You can see on their faces, they're all just kind of like, huh? But, but he quelled them to a certain degree. And, you know, I think enough kind of got enough of it. Like, all right, you know, fine. We'll let you... You know, they saw his heart or his imagination or whatever, but to me, that was a very real moment. You know, he really saw it that way, and that was, and I'm inspired by that kind of thing.
Well, especially since you had that interest in performance art, and so you have the connection, community, performance art. You know, something that is more overtly artistic. It's interesting. I saw that you did a David Byrne action figure, and I saw a picture of you rubbing shoulders with David. How was that?
It was a magical moment for me. He's a big hero of mine. I should have mentioned him. As an influence for sure. It's also going to make me wistful because that was a result of being in that gallery in New York City. It was a Jonathan Levine gallery. And he had a great spot in Chelsea. And Jonathan was the kind of gallery, he's on the ninth floor, he's not on the ground floor in Chelsea. This is like, for anybody who doesn't know, Chelsea is in the neighborhood of Manhattan where all the biggest art galleries, I would say, in the world are. Because it's not just local, big-time New York dealers. It's like somebody from Paris who has a branch in Chelsea also. And it's kind of moves around. Like, the neighborhood always changes. If it's not Soho, it's Chelsea. It's always like the old industrial meatpacking district of Manhattan, whatever that is, that gets converted to the big art spaces that they can afford to build out. Jonathan Levine was the gallery that didn't have champagne. He had beer kegs and chips for the opening. Like, it was that kind of place. It was on the ninth floor. You'd have to like kind of find it. But it was still a great location. So like on opening nights, you get hundreds of people flowing through and you get people like David Byrne wandering through because he lived in the neighborhood. The story to that picture goes that the night before the opening, we were out to dinner at a restaurant really close to the gallery, maybe a block away. And I saw him sitting two tables away and I'm freaking out. It was like hero of mine. I'm like, and I literally have the flyers for the show in my pocket. I was hustling around New York City, putting around. I'm already like talking it up. And so I'm like, I tell the table, it's Jonathan and his staff. I'm like, I want to go give him a card. They're like, and one of the staff women was like, no, I'll do it. I'm like, fine, go do it. She gets up to go. And as she does, he leaves and he's gone. And I feel this like moment of opportunity past, and this has happened to me, you know, however many times, any artist who's trying to do this. So I'm like, oh great, I lost it. And I couldn't believe it. He walked in the very next day. It turns out he's a regular. He'd already been going to the place, but I was just enamored. He went through the whole gallery. He kind of left. He was about to go to the elevator back down. I went on and grabbed him, like, David, can I gotta say, normally I don't gush, but you're a real hero of mine. It's amazing here. Can I bring you in, take a picture? He's, oh yeah, sure. And then he was kind of quiet. He was smiley. He was kind of laughy. And I ended up walking him through the whole show, explaining all the pieces. And
oh,
we had a whole little tour. And
what a moment. A
sweet, sweet man. Very gentle. And yeah.
Yeah, what a moment forever. Well, I wish we could go on talking forever because you have so many great stories. And so Mike Levitt's going to be at VCA starting November 7th. And your talk is the
November 9th at 2 p.m.
November 9th, which is the Sunday. At 2 p.m., and I bet you'll have fabulous stories. I am so excited because I love it when I find who's living on Vashon and these creative people and these you know, who have had international careers or have done things or are hoping to do things and are living right here with us. So thank you so much for taking time today.
Absolutely. I feel the same way about the island. I'm just constantly meeting amazing people, and even after 13 years, I feel like it's just keeps happening.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon 101.9 FM for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.